Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Roses are red, violets are blue, and today we talk about poetry, which doesn't always rhyme, as I just found out. Admittedly, poetry and English literature were my least favorite topics in high school and college, but to help set me straight, we have as today's guest Louis Marcos, the Robert H. Ray Chair in Humanities and Professor of English at Houston Baptist University. He is a noted expert on C.S. Lewis, who we'll talk a little bit about today, as well as being well-versed in ancient Greek and Roman literature, Victoria-era poetry and prose, mythology, and classic films, including the works of Alfred Hitchcock, Frank Capra, and I would assume all five versions of the Die Hard trilogy. He is the author of 9 books, the likes of which include From Achilles to Christ, Why Christians Should Read the Pagan Classics, The Eye of the Beholder, How to See the World Like a Romantic Poet, On the Shoulder of Hobbits, The Road to Virtue in Tolkien and Lewis, C.S. Lewis, An Apologist for Education, and Heaven and Hell, Visions of the Afterlife in the Western Poetic Tradition. He maintains his own blog over at Houston Baptist The City website, where you can find other interesting folks, including John Mark Reynolds, who we had on our program before, talking about A Christmas Carol, a delightful podcast about Charles Dickens. As always, links are provided at our website, so get on over there and bring a friend along as well. We're growing an audience and would like you to be a regular listener to our free educational show. Lou, welcome to Research on Religion.
Great to be here, Tony.
So, set this rational political economist straight about the world of prose. Why was I so wrong to tune out of college literature classes, and why should anybody care about poetry? I mean, I'm already married, so I don't need to pitch woo to anybody.
Well, I tell you, a book I wrote a few years ago called Literature, A Student's Guide, and the first chapter is called Why Literature Matters, particularly Why Poetry Matters. And I actually began my book by saying that if you want to know why literature and particularly poetry are important, don't ask an English major sitting out in the quadrangle. Ask a engineer or a doctor or a businessman in his 60s or 70s. He will be the one to tell you why literature matters. So we have this idea that, you know, a liberal arts education should be for people between the ages of 18 and 21. And I understand why it's the way things work. We got to get ready for our jobs. But a lot of times, we're not really ready to appreciate the humanities, and particularly literature and poetry, until we're older. Because a lot of times, it's after we've sort of made our mark and got our job and started to raise a family that we start realizing that, hey, once we make our money, we got to start asking those questions. Who am I? Why am I here? What is my purpose? And poetry, and again, I say literature, but until recently, it was poetry. I mean, a lot of people don't realize it's been like 100 years that people have studied novels as literature. Until fairly recently, literature meant poetry, which is what I focus on. And there was this idea that I still think is true, is that poetry takes us closer to the ideal, closer to the truth. We might say closer to the language of Adam. And again, you know, we need all these things, business and medicine and engineering. We need them. Those things have survival value. But literature gives value to survival. Maybe that's why we need to read it. And again, we don't often appreciate it because when we're 18, we don't have quite the life experiences to really dig in and join these great poets and wrestle alongside them and question ourselves and question our purpose and question our meaning. Sometimes we're just too distracted when we're young. We need to have life experience. So literature does matter. It opens up a whole new world, and it zeroes in on those human questions that at some point in our lives we all have to ask. if not answer. We need to ask them and wrestle with them.
Yeah, there's that old adage, education is wasted on the young.
It's true.
Yeah. I have to admit that from a political economy standpoint, and again, I mentioned I'm not a big fan of fiction literature or poetry, but you're here to help me set me straight on that thing. But as I've aged, I've gone back and read some of the older economic classics back in the Enlightenment period. I've been working my way through Adam Smith, both his Wealth of Nations and Theory of Moral Sentiments. And I find that I enjoy them much more now than I did when I had to do a quick read through my sophomore year in college or so. So, yeah, I think that's a very good insight that you have there.
Thanks.
One of the things that you talked about just a second ago that intrigued me, you said that literature always used to be called poetry. And for me, again, a political economist here, poetry is that stuff that you write on bathroom walls. That's the kind of thing. It always rhymes and things like that. And it's somehow different than literature. So explain to me, what is poetry, what is prose, and what is literature? Where do all those things fall into place?
It is a strange thing. We often think of poetry, and you know, especially in English, we think of poetry immediately as something that rhymes.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of poetry rhymes, but not all of it. For instance, the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Aeneid, Paradise Lost, they don't all rhyme. But what literature did have until very recently, we might call it rhythmic or metrical language. I'm sure you and a lot of your listeners will remember learning iambic pentameter. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. To be or not to be, that is the question. That's sort of the dominant rhythm in English literature poetry, because our language tends to fall into that. But the Iliad sounds like this. Dum da da 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 dum. That's a very, very long line. But generally speaking, poetry is, maybe a better way to put it, is that it's a heightened kind of language. In prose, every sentence counts. But in poetry, every word counts. All the connotations of those words, the arrangement of those words. That's why it's so hard to do a translation of poetry. It's a lot easier to translate prose into another language than poetry. In poetry, every word counts. Also, a huge difference, and we see this in prose, but not to the degree we see it in poetry, and that is the use of metaphorical or figurative language. Things like similes and metaphors and symbols and allegories. It's a meta language, we might say today, a language that points beyond itself. It, of course, wants to be understood, but it wants to work on a number of different levels. One of the ways I explain it to my students, especially in a freshman literature class, is when you're writing an essay or an interpretation of a poem, there's always more than one right answer, but there are wrong answers. Poetry doesn't mean whatever you want it to mean. That's what Humpty Dumpty says. Words mean whatever I want them to. That's not true of poetry. But it is true that poetry tries to move beyond what we would call a one-to-one correspondence, where there's one specific meaning and that's it. No, there are multiple levels of meaning, usually working vertically. In other words, there's a surface meaning and there's a deeper meaning and a deeper meaning going down and down and down. Whereas in prose, you're usually looking for the surface meaning, the basic clarity. Though, you know, some people, even like John Locke, some of those older writers are such stylists that they do rhetorical effects with their prose. Kind of going back to Cicero would be a great example of rhetorical prose. But again, in poetry, it's a more intense language, a more rhythmical language, a more metaphorical language. And it tries to deal very directly with issues and to hold them in a kind of suspension. One more thing is that poetry tends to make heavier use of things like irony and paradox and, you know, flipping ideas and whatnot, because, again, it wants to hold the meaning in tension.
Yeah, I'm going to give a big reveal here. This is, not many people know this. My wife does know this. She always asks why I don't read more poetry, prose, literature, you know, fiction, and things like that. And it goes back to my first year in college when I was in a literature class. And a moment ago, you said that there are no right answers in poetry, but there are wrong answers. And that struck a chord because one of the first books we read was Homer's The Odyssey. And I love that book. For me, it was like reading a comic book. It was fun, filled with adventure. But the professor had this thing about reading Freudian sexual connotations deep into this. And I said, come on, man, this is a heroic thing. And the subsequent books that we read as well, he read into that. And I said, oh, this is just kind of whatever you want it to be. And I just felt it was kind of a snaky and slippery class. I didn't really particularly like it from that point on.
Well, I will tell you, Tony, a lot of people talk about how literature, poetry, humanities, how they've been killed by the business majors. Mm. Not at all. Business majors usually mind their own business and bring in some good money to the school, help us out. But what's really killed the humanities is the humanities professors themselves have killed themselves because we have made literature sort of irrelevant. We've reduced everything to, you know, whatever, sexual politics, identity politics, race, class, and gender, Freudian psychoanalysis. We've killed the poetry. We no longer learn from the poetry. We want to use it to project our own theory and ideology, and it's just strangled it. No wonder people are less and less interested in the way they teach Hamlet and stuff with, you know, with the Freudianism and the feminism. I mean, everything, it becomes projected on. See, we used to have this word, and people were always worried about this, Tony, bardolatry, right? In other words, idolizing the bard, learning at the feet of the poet. Well, there may have been periods in, you know, aesthetic history when that was a problem. Not now. C.S. Lewis said in a book he wrote called The Abolition of Man that the task of the modern educator is not to tear down jungles, but to irrigate deserts. We are not too enthusiastic about learning poetry. We're too dry. We've lost our fervor for it, and it's become a whole industry of projecting, you know, these theoretical ideas. Theory in itself is not bad, but again, we want to turn everything into an embodiment of our own obsessions. Also, the same problem has come, and this is why Lewis is one of my heroes. We have gotten more and more and more and more specialized in the humanities. Now, I don't mind that too much in the sciences or medicine. If I've got something wrong with my eye, I want to go to an eye specialist. But what's happened over the last 100 years is that even literature has become specialized. So you'll get teachers that not only know, say, the Victorian age, they only know one decade of the Victorian age, or they only know one theory, and I guess they're trying to carve a niche out for themselves. I love Lewis because he's what we used to call a Renaissance man. Lewis, and I try to, you know, model this in my own life, is to try to draw in not only literature, but history and philosophy and theology and all these other things, even film for me for the 20th century, trying to draw in other genres, other mediums, so that we can draw closer to the good, the true, and the beautiful. You know, Tony, in the beginning of my book, I mentioned that there's something different about my book that people may notice if they read other academic books. And one of the differences, and this is also a difference that I try to bring out when I speak publicly, and that is, believe it or not, when I write or speak on Homer or Virgil or Dante or Plato, I am actually trying to get at the good, the true, and the beautiful. I actually believe that I can learn truths from these poets that might actually change my beliefs and my behaviors, and hopefully the beliefs and behaviors of the ones who read me or listen to my speech. Now, today, this would be considered unutterably naive. Lewis talks about it in his book, Screwtape Letters. I think it's number 27. Screwtape is a senior devil trying to write letters to a junior devil named Wormwood, teaching him how to tempt people. Basically, what Screwtape says in that letter is that, you know, it used to be that the devils would get in trouble because people knew the past, they read the great books, and so because of that knowledge, they were able to see through lots of the classic temptation techniques of the devil. But now, every age is cut off from every other age. We no longer have access or knowledge of the past And we make the same mistakes over and over again. I mean, if we still understood the heresy of Gnosticism and how it was dealt a decisive blow 1,700 years ago, we would have just dismissed the Da Vinci Code and seen right through it. But because we don't study and don't know the creeds, we make the same mistakes. Let's come back to literature. Okay. Now, Screwtape says there are a group of people who do spend their life studying the classics, both the Judeo-Christian and the Greco-Roman classics. They would be the ones that would have access to that wisdom and could help us. But, he says, those academics who know it are the last people in the world who can use it. And the reason for that is that Satan has fooled us with what he calls the historical point of view. This is how it works. To say you're taking a college class on Dante, let's say. Your teacher, even sometimes if your teacher's a Christian, your teacher will ask all sorts of questions. Who wrote this? When was it written? What were the influences? Who did it in? On a, what is the state of academic discourse? On and on. But there's one question that will never be asked. And that question is what the poet said true? And if you don't ask that question, Tony, if you don't ask, is it true, then nobody, teacher or student, is going to be challenged. They're not going to have their beliefs changed, and they're not going to have their actions changed. Lewis, C.S. Lewis, a lot of people know, was an atheist for many, many years before he became a believer. And one of the things that started poking a hole in him, Lewis always loved Plato. But one day he was listening to a friend of his, Owen Barfield, and a student who were both believers. And they were talking about Plato. And Lewis overheard them, and he suddenly thought, there's something strange here. They're talking about Plato in a different way. They're talking about Plato as if what he wrote actually matters, as if it could actually change your life. And that sort of revolutionized Lewis. Again, to me, there's no reason going back. And I mean, okay, Tony, we do need good technical people to go back, make sure we have a clean text, make sure this is more or less what Dante or Shakespeare said. I mean, we do need some technical things. I mean, we need these good linguistic things. But for most people, most professors, most students, they need to engage these works and to be willing to learn from them. And that means, and this is a big deal for me, Tony, is even though I'm a Christian, I can learn a great deal from great pagan writers like Homer and Plato and Aeschylus and Sophocles and Virgil and Cicero. We may talk about that a little bit later. It's part of my book. But again, the key element here, what is so often missing in school, and again, I hate to say it, but often Christian schools, is an engagement that is willing to learn, to sit at the feet of the author, rather than standing in judgment over the author. I can always tell when a seminarian is going bad, because they start by going into seminary and wanting to allow the Bible to judge them. By the time they leave, they're the ones standing in judgment over the Bible. We're criticizing it rather than it criticizing and searching us. And it's a very subtle shift. But when we lose that openness to wisdom, that humility that wants to seek wisdom, you know, like a beautiful woman, like Solomon in the Proverbs, when we lose that hunger, then, you know, it doesn't make a difference what we read. And that's why more and more in academia, people keep arguing, you know, complaining about this, you know they'll teach a class in pornography because it doesn't make a difference. Everything's just a text. We're not there to learn from it. We're there to project our own theories onto it. And again, this is like a cancer in academia, Tony, and in everything I write or speak, I try to counter that, as C.S. Lewis did. And again, that's why he's one of my heroes.
And that's one of the things that you do very well in this book. And let's turn to your book right now on Heaven and Hell, Visions of the Afterlife in the Western Poetic Tradition. You take it all the way back to the Old Testament, and you're willing to engage in the pagan authors, Plato and Aristotle and a number of others that you have here. What motivated this book, and why did you choose this long time span? Again, you go back to the Old Testament and carry this all the way through up to middle 20th century, so right around C.S. Lewis time.
One of my goals, one of my visions, and it's kind of neat because I've been teaching at Houston Baptist University now since 1991, and it's always been very much a Christian school, but you know, we kind of took a quantum leap when Dr. Robert Sloan, you know, came from Baylor and really helped. Then we had John Mark Reynolds there and all this sort of stuff. But one of my mottos has always been bringing Athens and Jerusalem together. And we have a vision at HBU called the Ten Pillars. And one of them is exactly that. Now, what does that mean, bring Athens and Jerusalem together? All right, by Athens, we mean the Greco-Roman tradition coming out of Greece and Rome, of course. By Jerusalem, we mean the Judeo-Christian. And to bring Athens and Jerusalem together is to draw together these two great streams, because that is what created Western civilization, particularly coming through Augustine. He's sort of joining together the stream, the river that flows out of Athens and one that flows out of Jerusalem, and they come together very much in Rome. And it is the desire. Okay, let's step back and put it this way. I am very uncomfortable, as many people are, thinking that until the coming of Jesus, God only spoke to the Jews, whatever they were, 0.5% of the human population, and ignored everybody else. Now, I do believe as a believer that only to the Jews did God give what we call special revelation. Only to the Jews did he speak directly through the Bible, through the prophets, through the law, the Torah. But he didn't ignore everybody else. For other people, and this is clear in the Bible, it's clear not only in Catholic theology, it's clear in Calvin's Institutes, if people read them carefully. The distinction between special revelation and general revelation is key to the Reformers just as much as it is to the Catholic Church. General revelation is the way God speaks generally to all people through nature, through our conscience, and Lewis adds this phrase, through the good dreams of the pagans. God does speak to us in many ways and in many forms, but he only speaks perfectly and directly to us through his Son. So one of my mottos, it's on my webpage, and I use it a lot when I speak, I like to put it this way. Christianity is not the only truth, but it is the only complete truth. And what I mean by that, Tony, is that to say that Christianity is the only truth, you're sort of dropping a wall and you're saying everything in Christianity is true, everything outside is absolute darkness, absolute error, absolute sin. I don't think so. I think you can find bits and pieces of truth in every religion, in every culture, because we are made in God's image. We bear the imago Dei. And though we are fallen, we don't cease to bear God's image. We are fallen and in sin, but we are still in God's image. And because of that, God speaks through us, and every culture has bits and pieces of truth. But the only place where you find truth in its complete form is in Christ himself, the one who said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And that's actually the motto, the verse motto of my university. I am the way, the truth, and no man comes to me but through the Father, but through me. And so the image I like is, rather than a wall between the pagan and the Christian, I want to see a staircase leading upwards. That if you take the higher truths in a Plato or a Homer or a Sophocles or a Cicero or a Virgil and lead upward to it, it will lose itself in the truth of Christ. And my two mottos, I'm a Baptist, so I've got to have some good biblical backup here. And the two stories that not only are at the core of my vision, of my mission that God has given me, but very much at the core of this book, Heaven and Hell, and an earlier book I wrote called From Achilles to Christ, Why Christians Should Read the Pagan Classics. Heaven and Hell is a sort of sequel to that book, not literally, but working in the same vein. And here's my motto. First of all, my favorite Christmas story is the journey of the Magi. Who are the Magi? Well, they're obviously not Christians. There aren't any yet. But they're also not Jews. As far as we know, they didn't have access to the Old Testament, to the Torah. They only had their limited pagan wisdom studying the stars. Right? But they yearned for the truth, right? And they followed that star, and it led them to the Christ child. Now, when the Magi got there, they could have said this: you have got to be kidding me. We came 1,000 miles for this. The kid just dirtied his diaper. I'm going home, and I'm never following another stupid star. That's not what the Magi said. They could have. And many people do say that today when they come, to the idea that Christ is the one way to God, and I'm out of here. But the Magi didn't say that. What the Magi said is, yes, this is what we have been seeking all our lives. We never could have guessed it, but now that we are here in front of it, we recognize that this is the truth that we've yearned for and could never quite put our finger on. You see, when St. Paul, came to Athens, Acts chapter 17, you'll know the story, many of your listeners will know the story. He comes to Athens, he's in the agora, the marketplace, and he looks around and sees that there are idols everywhere. One ancient critic said there, it's easier to find a god than a man in Athens. There were just idols everywhere. Well, then Paul saw an idol to an unknown god. And then, because Paul had read books, you understand, Tony, he said, I know what I'm going to do. So he goes up to the Areopagus, a meeting with the elders who kind of, you know, looked at all the new philosophical, theological ideas. They were mostly Stoics and Epicureans. And he came before them and said, men of Athens, which is the way that Socrates began all of his speeches. He said, men of Athens, I can see that in all ways you are a religious people. For I see that you have temples. He didn't say idols. He makes a bridge. I see that you have temples to all the gods. I even see that you have a temple to an unknown god. And then Paul, and by the way, I'm actually Greek. All four of my grandparents were born in Greece, so this is very personal to me. Then I think that Paul spoke the sentence that the entire Greco-Roman world was waiting to hear. He said these simple words, now therefore, what you have worshipped in ignorance, I will proclaim to you as known. For the God who created everything does not dwell in temples made by human hands. For out of one man he created all other races of men. He set their times and places so that they all might reach and grope after him, though they are not far from him. For in him we live and move and have our being. As your own poets, your own pagan poets have said, we are his offspring. Now, a lot of people don't realize Paul is actually quoting two different pagan poets. One pagan poet named Epimenides said, in him we live and move and have our being. A different one named Aratus said, we are his offspring. So here is Paul quoting two pagan bits of poetry and saying that there is truth in these. You guys don't know the whole truth, but this truth is pointing towards the revelation I'm going to tell you about how the Son of God, Christ, came to the earth, died, and resurrected. Right? Something new has come into the world, but you are not wholly ignorant of it. There are bits and pieces of truth. So I want to go back. I do believe, I don't just say this as a literary person, I believe that God, the God of the Bible, used people like Homer and Plato and Virgil to prepare the ancient world for the coming of Christ. And in the beginning of the church, a lot of the pagans were the ones that were most quickly converted, who saw the link between the two. So this is the whole purpose. What do I want to do? I want to trace this, you know, this obsession, maybe is a negative word. I want to trace this fascination that we as a species have always had with heaven and hell and with the afterlife. I want to go back to the beginnings. Now, I'm focusing on the Western world. That's what I'm doing here. But let's go back to the early beginnings, both in Judaism, but particularly in ancient Greece and Rome, and trace it and see if there is a development. Let's see. And it's interesting. I've got 24 chapters. The first 12 chapters are pagan. The second 12 chapters are Christian, though not exactly, because the first 12 chapters end with Dante's Inferno. Now, Dante's Inferno, of course, is a Christian work, just like Purgatory and Paradise, but the way I present it and the way I think Dante would want it presented is that his Inferno in particular sums up all the truths that he has learned from Homer and Virgil and Plato. Now, there still is, you know, Athens is still up there in Purgatory and Paradise, but much more strongly I see the sort of climax coming in the Inferno. So I build up, I start with you know, the Hebrew version of Sheol and Hades. I look at Homer's Odyssey because that's the first great literary descent into the underworld. Then I move on from there to look at Plato, because a lot of people don't realize that Plato exerted as much influence as the poets did on people like Virgil and Dante. So a couple chapters on Plato. Then Virgil's Aeneid, which gives us an entire book, a very long book, most complex descent into the underworld in the pre-Christian world. Then I look quickly at Cicero. He was a little bit before Dante. I'm sorry, a little bit before Virgil, still 1st century B.C. And he wrote a famous little thing called The Dream of Scipio, where he's given a sort of vision of heaven and the afterlife that influenced Virgil. Then I move into Dante, and the rest of Part 1, chapters 1 to 12, you know, kind of climaxes with Dante's Inferno, trying to draw all of this into a Christian understanding. Then, before moving on to Purgatory and Paradise, I pause and I have a chapter on the biblical understanding, particularly the New Testament understanding of heaven and hell. Because to me, here's the right time. Now let's, you know, just do this, and then we can come back and see how it influenced Purgatory and Paradise. Then after that, the logical next step is Milton's Paradise Lost. Then I look a little bit at John Bunyan, who wrote Pilgrim's Progress, and John Donne, a poet that talked a lot about the resurrection. Then I move on to the modern, where my specialty was actually romantic poetry. My dissertation was on Wordsworth over at University of Michigan. And so I talk about how the romantic did something weird. They turned Satan into the hero of Paradise Lost. So I sort of wrestle with that. Then I have a little sort of point-counterpoint. There was the most radical of the romantics was a man named William Blake. And he wrote a book called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. It's called half poetry and half prose, kind of strange hybrid genre he invented. But in it, he posits in a sort of extreme romantic fashion that heaven and hell are just states of mind. It just depends how you look at them. Well, about 150 years after he wrote that, C.S. Lewis wrote a book called The Great Divorce. And a lot of people, you know, it's a shame. I've read all of Lewis. I love him. I write at him. If I had to choose my favorite Lewis book, one book, it would be The Great Divorce. But I think a lot of people don't read it because they say, what does that mean? What's so great about divorce? Actually, it has nothing to do with divorce. It is a direct refutation of the marriage of heaven and hell. Lewis, and he explains this in his preface, but Lewis announces the divorce from heaven. No, there is nothing in common between heaven and hell. You choose one or the other. You can't have both. And we might, you know, end this hour talking about that if you'd like. But, you know, Lewis takes up, and then I end quickly by looking at the Victorian age where what happened was that the desire of heaven was muted because everybody wanted to make heaven on earth. And then I end finally by looking quickly at the interesting rise in stories of life after life experiences, or also known as near death experiences, which we're seeing more and more, and perhaps offering physical, scientific proof, if you will, of the afterlife. And so you see it's a movement of about almost 3,000 years. But I like to do that. I like to write what I call synthetic books. Synthetic, not meaning fake, but meaning books that synthesize or draw together. This is my passion as a professor and as a lecturer. And I find that when I give speeches, what moves the audience the most, and actually what moves me the most when I'm the audience, is when the speaker makes connections between things I hadn't made before. Not just connections between books, but connections between literature and philosophy and history. So I want to draw everything together under the rubric of poetry, though. You see, I write this book as a literature person who is injecting philosophy and theology. You can read other books by people that are looking at it from a philosophical or theological point of view. I'm trying to come at it, what is the truth we can learn from literature? Because I do see, I refuse to give in, and Lewis did too. Tony, maybe some of your speakers here that you've had have talked about what we call the Enlightenment split. The way since the Enlightenment, we've cut ourselves in half, so on one side is fact and the other side is fiction. One side is fact and the other side is values, and they never meet. I really think a lot of reasons people are suspicious of poetry, including and especially Christians, is because they think poetry is made up, it's fiction, therefore it is the foe of fact, and why do I want to be lied to? This is one of the big, we don't even realize what we're doing. But no, you know, the old concept of a myth is a story that points to the truth. The story may be true, it may not be true, but it's mythical because it points to the great questions. It points to origins. It also points to destinations, alpha and omega, beginning and end.
I might have to consider myself one of those people who is suspicious about fiction because it points away from truth. But you're making a very strong case here that it does reveal truth. And I want to walk through this. You gave a wonderful outline of what your book is, but let's try to pull out what some of those truths are. And one of the most interesting things that caught my eye in your book was right at the beginning. And again, you go back to the Old Testament days, you go back to Plato, you go back deep in ancient history, but you start off with C.S. Lewis noting that humans are the only species that fear their own dead. And then you use that to catapult yourself back in history and then start to weave the threads of this long fabric of how poetic thinkers have thought about heaven and hell. First off, explain, what do you mean, or what did C.S. Lewis mean when he said that humans are the only species that fear their own dead, and how does this weave into it?
Let's talk about this, because it's fascinating. Lewis wrote a book called The Problem of Pain. It was his first really apologetics book. A very popular, led to him giving the broadcast talks. but it has a lot to do other than just pain. And in his introduction, he makes a fascinating argument for the origin of religion. He tries to say that religion comes from God. Religion is not man-made. Because you need to understand, Tony, that in our modern world, when we talk about something like evolution versus creation, we're not just talking about science. The modern paradigm says that everything evolved, not just our body. Our soul evolved, consciousness evolved, language evolved, religion evolved, and it all evolved by natural material forces. Lewis said, no, they come from above. Okay, what does this got to do with your question? Lewis says that what a lot of people like H.G. Wells, H.G. Wells was a pretty famous atheist, and Lewis often debated ideas with him in prose. He didn't debate him directly, but he often debated him in his books. According to Wells and other people, he wrote something called The Outline of History. The origin of religion is this, okay? We begin with the fear of wild animals, right? We fear being killed and eaten and all that stuff. That's the caveman, right? And then that fear evolves into a fear of the unknown, and that evolves into a fear of religion. But Lewis said, no, you're playing games here. I get very upset when I debate with Darwinists and they refuse to talk about the difference between micro and macro evolution. They're not the same thing, okay? Well, in the same way, they're playing around with the word fear. They're using the same word for fear of wild animals and fear of the unknown or fear of ghosts. But the meaning is totally different. All right. If you're in a room and I tell you on the other side of that door is a lion or a bear, you are going to be afraid. If I tell you on the other side of that door is a ghost, you're also going to be afraid, but it's going to be a totally different kind of fear. The link between the two is not quantitative. It's not like you're afraid of wild men and you're a little more afraid of them, and then suddenly, boom, out of nowhere, you're afraid of the supernatural. No, it's not a quantitative difference. It's a qualitative difference. Only human beings have that fear of the unknown. The word is a numinous fear. Lewis learned the word from a man named Rudolf Otto, who wrote a book called The Idea of the Holy. The numinous fear is that fear that gives you goose flesh, that, you know, makes pimples jump out on you. And Lewis makes it very clear. Only human beings are afraid of their dead. When we go to the graveyard, we're afraid. If a dog goes to the doggy graveyard, it's not afraid, okay? Only, and this is weird. Why are we afraid of ghosts? Ghosts can't hurt us. What can they do to us? And yet we are afraid. When Tarzan is on top of the elephant and he marches into the graveyard of the elephant, and that's what he always wants to find because that's where the ivory is, right? When he feels a shoo, oh my God, this is scary. The elephants don't feel afraid, okay? It's a very, very strange thing. Where does this come from? A lot of psychologists, even ones that aren't necessarily religious, will admit that we as a species are not just Homo sapiens, we are Homo religiosus. We are religious man. There is something in us that responds to the supernatural. And we just can't do away with it. And again, Lewis says it's not something that evolves. You don't, you know, it's not like a higher ape is a little bit afraid of the graveyard, and then we're really afraid of it. This is something wholly new. As Chesterton would say, it's not an evolution, it's a revolution. We do naturally feel afraid. That, another word that Lewis uses is the uncanny or the numinous. Well, I want to begin there in my book, Tony, because what I'm getting at is we all experience a sort of yearning for the afterlife, a fear of it, a dread of it. We have these feelings that we can't just get rid of. I would say even people that are atheists still, you know, I'll bet if they sleep overnight in the cemetery, they're going to be afraid. We have a sense of the otherworldly. We have a sense that there is a part of us that is not simply physical, natural material. Maybe the easiest way to put this, there's a difference between our brain and our mind, our brain and our soul, our psyche. Plato used the word psyche, which means both soul and mind at the same time, our psyche, our consciousness. And we are conscious of the fact that there is a part of us that rises above the physical world and that will persist. Even the secular psychologists admit that, you know, nobody can imagine their own death, by which they mean imagine their own extinction. We will not be annihilated. There is something in us that will persist. And that's why I think in even the most primitive societies, there is a natural understanding of the afterlife, of having to appease the spirits, of yearning for it. This is not something that was impressed upon us by society. This is something that rises up naturally from our own dual nature, being both physical, like the animals, and spiritual, like the angels. Of course, what the Bible says is we're not half and half, but we're both. We're an enfleshed soul. We are fully physical and fully spiritual. And I begin here because what I'm arguing is this is the origin. This is not something man-made. The origin is our own deep inner sense, that numinous, uncanny sense that is wholly distinct from the animals. Totally. You know, I love it. G.K. Chesterton wrote a book called The Everlasting Man, where he wants to debunk this kind of silly idea of the caveman, which people think has been proven or something. And he says, you know, what is this caveman, like half ape, half man? The earliest evidence we have of the caveman are those drawings in France, you know, in the caves of France. And Chesterton looks at those drawings and says, this is not primitive art. This is art using primitive tools. The person that made this art was fully 100% human. No ape begins to create, or no ape begins to create. Well, in the same way, only human beings have this fascination, fear, joy, jubilation having to do with the afterlife. It's not there in the animal kingdom, but it's there in us, and from a very young age, children understand this sort of thing. So I want to explore it, and I want to explore it not just theologically or philosophically, but poetically, because I think we speak, and whatever our soul comes out, if you will, our desires come out, I think, most strongly sometimes in poetry. And it comes out from very, very early on. And like I said, the beginning in the Western world of poetry, of course, would be the Odyssey. But we have, you know, we have a sense of this. I mean, you know, it's really funny, Tony. I teach the Greeks, and one of the plays I teach is Antigone. And most of your listeners will know that what happens with Antigone is there's a sort of civil war, and these two brothers kill each other. And their uncle, Creon, who's the king, decides the only way we can bring order in Thebes after this civil war is that I'm going to take one brother and give him, you know, a hero's burial, and I'm going to take the other brother and throw his body to the dogs. And I'm going to decree that anybody that tries to give proper burial to this guy is going to be killed. Well, then those two brothers, their sister Antigone, the niece, says this is wrong, and she gives proper burial and ends up leading to her death. And sometimes it's like we feel like we have to explain to the students that in ancient Greece it's a very bad thing to desecrate a body and leave it to death, as if it's not a bad thing today. As if this were, I mean, it's kind of weird. We almost, I mean, maybe their way of doing it seems primitive, but we understand that it's wrong. Okay, you don't just desecrate a body. There's something, that there's a soul, that there's some part of us that needs to be at rest. So again, I think we do instinctively understand these things, even the most primitive ones. I don't think we're that different.
We probably aren't that different, and we inherit a lot of our similarities throughout the ages here, and that's one of the points that you're making with your book. And as you noted, Homer's The Odyssey is our first poetic, epic poem here that we start off with in Western civilization. Lead us through a little bit of the visions of heaven and hell, starting with Homer, and tell us how this affects us today and where that thread is woven through the fabric of Western civilization and humanity in general.
Good. They have, in poetry, we have a phrase called a nekria. Comes from the word necros, necrophilia, necromancer, the Greek word for dead, necropolis. Nekria is a descent into the underworld. And now, Homer is not the first. It's just the first that's kind of written down, or orally, and then written down, because one of the oldest stories, and I start my book with the story, is the story of Orpheus and Eurydice, how Orpheus went down into the underworld to rescue his wife, right? But, you know, that was maybe one of the oldest stories. In fact, there was a mystical sort of cultic religion called Orphism that we don't know a whole lot about, but goes back to this story of Orpheus. Well, kind of based on that story and maybe other stories, Homer gives us the first literary nekria, or descent into the underworld. And what happens is Odysseus is on his travels. He fought at the Trojan War, and now he's trying to get back home to Ithaca, his island kingdom. And he just keeps being led astray. He did some bad things, got Poseidon, the god of the sea, mad at him. And so he's wandering all over the place. For a while, he ends up in the island of Circe, where he spends a whole year. Finally, he wants to go home, but Circe, the goddess, tells him, she's a kind of a witch goddess, tells him, at first you need to make a voyage to the underworld, to Hades, and there meet with the blind poet Tiresias. By the way, that's the same Tiresias who pops up in both Oedipus and Antigone, those plays. He's the blind prophet of Thebes. Now he's in the underworld. Go there and speak with him, and he will give you a warning to help you get home. Now, there's something really strange, Tony, when you read this book carefully. Because he goes there, Tiresias gives him a bunch of warnings about the sirens and Scylla and Charybdis, and then he gets back to Circe, and she tells him the same thing. So I'm looking back and saying, what practical thing does he really learn from Tiresias? It's repeated later. Well, I would argue, and another critic who I think would agree with me, is that that's only the reason, whatever, the pretext to get him down there. He's a hero, and he needs to face his own death. He needs to face his own capacity for despair. While he's in the underworld, he does meet the dead spirit of his mother and others and whatnot. But I think what we get and why it's so popular is when we go down there, we're not only, getting information about the afterlife and all, but we are facing our own fears, our own dread. That's something that a hero has to do. And, it even happens to a certain extent in the last great epic written, Lord of the Rings, by J.R.R. Tolkien. And if you know that story, there's one part where Aragorn, our great king, our messianic king, has to go to the paths of the dead and waken up the dead oathbreakers to bring them in to help fight the war. Almost everybody, Gandalf, dies, falls into the mines of Moria, and rises again. Even Frodo goes into the cave of Shelob the spider and is essentially killed and brought back. The hero, it becomes part of the heroic quest to face the afterlife and to come to grips with our own death, right? The way we deal with death has to be important, maybe as important as the way we deal with life. We are finite creatures, and yet there's something in us that's immortal. That's strange about us. That's troubling about us. And so, we get the very basic outlines in Homer. In fact, if you read it carefully, it's kind of weird. In some senses, Odysseus never actually goes into the underworld. He seems to stand at the mouth of the cave and the spirits come to him. It gets kind of confused as you read it. But he's the one that, goes, asks questions and answers, sees the spirits of departed heroes, and it becomes epic conventions sort of spring up. But again, it's not on a huge scale. Then you get to Plato. Again, Plato doesn't write any poetic epics. In fact, Plato's famous for kicking out the poets. And yet, Plato is in some ways the greatest poet of them all. And Plato, of course, is famous for his dialogues. And in his dialogues, he has what we call a dialectic, question and answer, Socratic method. And he debates, ethical and philosophical and theological matters. What is the nature of justice? That's what the famous Republic is about. But what I love about Plato, especially since I'm a literature person, more than a philosophy person, is that he'll give you this long philosophical discourse, all these questions, and then he will lose himself in a myth. Most of his great dialogues, the Phaedo, the Republic, the Gorgias, the Phaedrus, so many of his greatest, the Timaeus also, and also the Symposium, all of his great epics end not with a logical proof, but with a myth, often a myth that has to do with the end times, by which I mean the final judgment and heaven and hell. In the Republic, probably the best-known one, he ends with the myth of Ur, about a soldier who has what I call the first life-after-life experience in literature. He dies and comes back and tells the story. And he goes down and sees the afterlife, because you see, the afterlife always is about judgment. You almost can't separate them, this idea of heaven and hell. And if we're going to understand the nature of justice, we need to take it to the very end. Why do the ways of sinners prosper? A book like Job, a book like Habakkuk in the Bible. How do we answer these questions? And, you know, it's hard to answer a full bit about justice without having a love story arc taking us to the end, heaven and hell, to judgment or reward. So we move on, and so Plato has some dialogues, like the Phaedo, where he lays out the geography of hell. He talks about the rivers of hell, how it works. It's really kind of elaborate. But other ones, he wants to show us how our life moves on to this final end, that there's a continuity. Because he was influenced by Pythagoras, Plato actually often talks about reincarnation. But even there, he has it that we choose our new life, our new lot in life. And it depends how we live, whether we will have the wisdom to choose the right thing. So he adds even more of a philosophical and theological aspect. But before Dante, the major pre-Christian nequia, or descent into the underworld, really climaxes with Virgil. You know, Virgil died just about 19 years before Christ was born, at the height, just as the Roman Republic is turning into the Roman Empire, and he writes the great epic of them all, just kind of gathering together everything that came before him. And it's much longer. It's about twice as long as the epic descent is in the Odyssey. And Aeneas, who is the great hero for Virgil, he is the legendary founder of what will become the Roman Empire. He needs to go in the underworld and see. And what's amazing is that Virgil takes everything in Homer and Plato and people, Cicero, others before him, and then goes one better. Because while he's in the underworld, he not only meets his father, he not only sees the blessed isles, what they call the Elysian Fields, but he sees in the underworld the souls of the great Romans who 500, 1,000 years later will come into the earth and act out their drama. So what he's seeing in the underworld is sort of the beginning and the end. He's seeing the seed of everything. Suddenly the stakes have been raised. We're going to a mythic world that overlies with the historical world. There's no simple separation, history versus myth. We're trying to find truth there. And he takes us, that's sort of what's like. And what's amazing is that when we get to Dante, the greatest of all the books about heaven and hell, here's Dante, this great Catholic Christian writer. Who is he going to choose as his guide through hell and purgatory? He doesn't choose Augustine or Aquinas or Peter or Paul or anybody, or Jesus, anybody like that. He chooses Virgil, a pagan poet. He understands that, in a sense, Virgil is a pre-Christian, somebody whom the God of the Bible used to prepare the world, the Christian world, without him knowing it. And so he realizes that in Virgil is the climax of general revelation. For Dante, Virgil is as far as we can go without direct special revelation that we get in the Bible. And so Virgil becomes an embodiment of the farthest human reason can go without divine grace. Now, Virgil can only take him through Inferno and Purgatory. When he gets to Paradise, we've now exceeded the limit of Virgil's discernment. And so we switch over to Beatrice, the beautiful woman who represents divine grace and special revelation. But he takes us on this journey, and he shows us, you know, when people first read Dante, sometimes we're too quick to reduce it to, oh, it's just simple punishment to fit the crime. You could have got a bunch of adolescent boys to sit down and write this and come up with nasty punishments, you know, like these slasher films. No, that's not what's going on. It is punishment to fit the crime. That is justice. But it's more than that. The sin creates the punishment. In a sense, the sinners in hell have become their sin. See, when I read Dante, I not only see the theology of sin, I see what I like to call the psychology of sin. He shows us what sin does to us, what it makes out of us. As Christians, we're like, how can people be in hell? Doesn't the Bible tell us to love the sinner and hate the sin? The sad truth of hell is that in hell there no longer really is a sinner. The sinner has become his sin. Let me jump ahead for a moment to the great divorce. In that book by C.S. Lewis that I mentioned earlier, Lewis imagines, what if the people in hell could get on a bus and take the bus to heaven? And when they get there, the souls of the saints, often their relatives or friends, come out and try to convince them, even now, to give up their sin, their disobedience, their pride, and open up and embrace the love and grace and mercy of Christ. What would they do? Lewis shows us, not only theologically, but psychologically, that with one exception, every single one of them willingly choose to go back to hell and their sin. And there's one scene, and basically when you read this book, Tony, it almost reads like a psychology book. If you ever read psychology, they're often what are called case study books, right? We have a series of case studies that sort of, like this one story sort of embodies that neurosis, and then we move on to another one. Well, this is what happens. What happens is that Lewis, and therefore us, overhear a series of dialogues between the sinner and the saint come to help him. Well, one of them, Lewis overhears, is between a blessed saint and this garrulous, grumbling old woman. Now, I call it a dialogue, but it's not really a dialogue, because this old woman goes on and on, grumbling and grumbling, complaining and complaining, so that the poor saint can't even get a word in edgewise. Finally, Lewis, in despair, turns to his guide, George MacDonald, and he says, "Sir, I don't understand this. I mean, that woman doesn't seem that bad to me. I mean, she's just a grumbler. Is that worthy of her being in that terrible place down there?" And George MacDonald says in his Scottish accent, "Ah, that is the question. Is she a grumbler, or is she only a grumble? If there's one spark of humanity left in that woman, the angels can blow on it till it becomes a roaring fire. But if all that's left is ashes, we'll not go on blowing ashes in our face forever." You see, the problem with that woman, Tony, is not that she is beyond salvation. God's grace is a great thing. The real problem is that there's nothing left to save. This is what we're getting to. I think in the greatest, from Virgil to Dante, there's the understanding that hell is not just a destination. Hell is a process. It's not just somewhere we go. It's somewhere we become. We cannot fully understand heaven and hell until we get to Christianity, and I'll tell you why. Because ultimately, if you want a simple capsule definition of what heaven and hell are, heaven means being in the presence of God for eternity. Hell means being cast out of the presence of God for eternity. See, that's something that Virgil and Homer couldn't understand because they didn't have perfect, pure, holy gods. I think they were moving in that direction. I think when you read Plato, we're moving towards an understanding of monotheism, not perfect, but an understanding that if there's a God, he must be perfect and holy, but you still don't have that. Only once we fully get that, we fully understand what heaven means, being in the direct presence of God, and hell being left on the outside. Choosing, ultimately, sin is idolatry. We choose something in place of God. There is something we are holding on to so desperately, we cannot let it go and embrace the mercy of Christ. And again, I see that movement. I only see the full flowering of it in Dante and other Christian writers, Milton and whatnot. But it's there, inchoately, it's there in essence, in embryo, in Homer and Plato and Virgil and Cicero. And what I love is that Dante doesn't say, "All right, throw out all this stuff. We just, you know, Europe just wasted the first half of their, you know, existence." No. He wants to take what is right and run with it. I teach, I'm a literature professor, but I also teach at Baptist University's Honors College, where we have a classical Christian curriculum. And I've been teaching in that since it started, about 6-7 years ago. And I also speak a lot for homeschoolers, and I speak a lot for classical Christian schools. In fact, this book and from Achilles to Christ were partly written with these classical Christian schools in mind. Tony, if you remember, it's not that long ago, 10, 15 years ago, a lot of homeschool Christians were Bible-only people. That was it. Now, they these conservative Christians, like myself, conservative evangelicals, they have taken up the pagan classics. At the same moment that Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Stanford, all of these so-called Ivy League schools are throwing out the tradition and reading, I don't know, Caribbean lesbian writers or something, at the same moment they're throwing out the classics, it is the least likely people, these evangelical Christians who in some ways used to be a little bit afraid of these things, right? They're picking it up, and there is a renaissance going on at schools like mine and other places. It's uncanny, and it's beautiful, and it is a reclaiming of these things. One of my favorite stories is a story I heard about General Booth, the guy that started the Salvation Army. As you know, the Salvation Army is famous for their brass bands playing all these songs. Well, apparently, one day, William Booth was up in a balcony, whatever, and he was listening to his brass band playing a beautiful hymn. And he said to one of the lieutenants, you know, I recognize those words, but where's that tune? It's such a beautiful tune. And apparently the lieutenant guy got a little bit embarrassed, and he said, well, the name of that tune is Champagne Charlie is my name. In other words, it was a drinking song, as was our national anthem, right, Star Spangled Banner. And apparently, after he heard that, General Booth put down his foot and said, darn it, why should the devil have all the best tunes? And then he started raiding all of the, you know, bar songs and whatnot and sending them to music and making Christian hymns. We need to reclaim, one of Lewis's favorite words, rehabilitate. We need to go back and reclaim and rehabilitate the truth. We need to plunder the Egyptians. That's how Augustine and others said it, right? If you remember, when the Jews left Egypt, God told them to, you know, ask for, you know, rings and whatnot, and therefore they plundered the Egyptians and took it. Moses, as Stephen tells us in the book of Acts, Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. Daniel was educated in all the wisdom of the Magi, really, of the Babylonians. And they used that wisdom to serve Christ. And you've heard the phrase, all truth is God's truth. Whatever is good and true and beautiful, reflect on me. This is what T.S. Eliot called the permanent things. We can learn a great... And I'm somebody that, you know, oftentimes my devotionals, I read Greek mythology as a devotional sometimes. There's great truth there to be learned, to be accessed, to be taken up into the greater truth. A lot of your readers will know, especially if they're evangelicals like me, there are a lot of real conservative Christians for a while that wouldn't celebrate Christmas. Because, yes, they probably chose December 25th because it was a pagan holiday. When Constantine came along and, you know, changed over the Roman Empire, they were already celebrating the birthday of the unconquerable sun. They were celebrating the Saturnalia. There were pagan things going on. Now, for a lot of conservatives, a lot of conservative Christians, I mean, evangelicals, a lot of us are like, oh, there go those Catholics watering down the faith. But no, I don't believe that's what they're doing. What they're doing is they're building a bridge. They're saying, you're already celebrating something that has a seed of truth, the return of the golden age, the return of the one that will save. Right? You're already worshiping that. Let me build a bridge to lead you to the real Messiah. You see, that's what I'm trying to do. That's what so many of the great writers from Plato to Dante, I'm sorry, not Plato, from Dante to Milton, to C.S. Lewis, to Chesterton, they're all, Newman is another one, Cardinal Newman, they're all trying to, and Tolkien too, trying to build a bridge. Let's take the best of what is there and lead it upward till we reach the Christ child, like the Magi.
And that is a wonderful lesson to conclude on here. There's so much going on in your book, Heaven and Hell, Visions of the Afterlife in the Western Poetic Tradition. We haven't been able to cover Milton or Bunyan or a number of the other folks in there, but I invite folks to pick up the excitement that you have for these authors and read it for yourself. My guest today has been Lou Marcos. Lou, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks so much, Tony. It was a great hour.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.